This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. National security officials in Washington, D.C. are declining to comment on a newspaper report that President Trump approved military strikes against Iran Thursday, then pulled back for unknown reasons. According to the New York Times, Mr. Trump initially authorized attacks on a handful of Iranian targets, such as radar and missile batteries. This is in response to Iran's shootdown of a U.S. drone and suggesting it was an accident. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports on that incident.
The Air Force's top Mideast commander says it was an unprovoked attack on a drone flying in international airspace over the Strait of Hormuz.
An attempt to disrupt our ability to monitor the area.
But minutes after Lieutenant General Joseph Guastella spoke, the president suggested the attack was unintentional.
I would imagine it was a general or somebody that made a mistake in shooting that drone down.
Retired Army Colonel David Maxwell says that's possible.
Mistakes happen.
Albeit with consequences. Asked about a U.S. response, the president repeatedly said, "You'll find out." Sagar Magani at the Pentagon.
Democrats in Congress are urging President Trump to use caution in the U.S. response to the downing of the plane.
After a briefing by the White House, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says he's concerned about the escalation.
The president may not intend to go to war here, but we're worried that he and the administration may bumble into a war.
And he says he reminded the president that he would need authorization from Congress before launching any military action against Iran. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says it's crucial that the U.S. consult with allies before taking any action.
We know that the high-tension wires are up there, and we must do everything we can not to escalate the situation.
She says she is convinced Iran launched an unprovoked attack.
We have an untrustworthy adversary.
And says President Trump did not reveal the options being considered. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
This is VOA News. The Saudi-led military coalition fighting in Yemen said on Friday it had struck targets around the port city of Hodeidah belonging to the Iran-aligned Houthi. The coalition strike came after the Houthis fired a missile at a utility plant in southern Saudi Arabia. Coalition said in the statement carried by the state media that its targets included booby-trap boats that the Houthis had prepared for terrorist acts and to threaten international shipping. Houthis, who ousted the Saudi-backed internationally recognized government from power in the Yemeni capital in late 2014, stepped up missile and drone attacks on Saudi cities in the past 2 weeks. Last week, a rebel missile hit an international airport in Saudi Arabia, wounding about 26 people. A Turkish court sentenced 151 people, including 17 senior military officers, to life in prison Thursday over a 2016 coup attempt against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Local media report 33 defendants were acquitted of charges at Thursday's trial. According to Turkish media, a court in Ankara sentenced 128 people to aggravated life sentences and 23 people to normal life for their participation in a 2016 coup that left more than 200 dead and 2,000 people injured. In July of 2016, elements of the Turkish armed forces mobilized in cities across the nation seeking to unseat Erdogan. Loyalist Turkish forces put down the coup hours after it began, with many of the participants surrendering. Lawyers who visited a border detention site in Clint, Texas, say that the conditions for children there are dangerous. AP correspondent Shelley Atlee.
A legal team recently interviewed over 60 children at a border patrol station in Texas and had this warning. A dangerous and traumatic situation is unfolding for some 250 infants, children, and teens locked up for up to 27 days without enough food, water, and sanitation. Customs and Border Protection did not immediately respond to the allegations about the conditions, but has said in recent weeks that it's overwhelmed and it needs more money and help from Congress. Shelley Antler, Washington.
Americans would rather have NASA closely monitor asteroids and comets that could crash into Earth rather than send an astronaut to the moon or Mars. An Associated Press Norick Center for Public Affairs Research poll released Thursday found two-thirds of respondents said monitoring asteroids, comets, and other events in space that could impact Earth was very or extremely important. Americans also want NASA to do more research to further the understanding of Earth, the solar system, and the universe. But once again, the respondents said that they want NASA to conduct the research using robots, not human astronauts. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian First Lady Claire Weah launches a program to seek the welfare of women and girls.
The opportunity for women and girls to live out their true meaning, being given the most valuable skills, protection, and place to develop must be evident.
The Mukwege Foundation helps to end the stigma of rape survivors. A Gambian army general confesses to torturing detainees during Yahya Jammeh's administration. We'll tell you why South Sudan lawmakers booed the country's finance minister yesterday. And Malawi's High Court could rule today on the petition challenging the re-election of President Mutharika.
We want accountability in the way how Malawi Commission managed the election. There were so many irregularities, but most officials were not taking to task in terms of explaining to Malawi so many issues.
Gift Trapens is the vice president of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Forum, and an art exhibition in Senegal's capital shines a light on the real effects of phosphate mining. Those story plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian First Lady Claire Weah yesterday, Thursday, launched a flagship program to seek the welfare of women and girls. According to the First Lady, the She's You initiative will focus on protecting Liberian women and girls from rape, new HIV infections, as well as provide care services for the most vulnerable groups. The initiative was launched in Monrovia by President George Weah at an elaborate ceremony attended by some first ladies from the West Africa sub-region. Moses Gaziewu reports from Monrovia.
It was a festive event that brought together hundreds of Liberians, especially women, at the Centennial Pavilion in Monrovia. In a fire-up speech, the Shizu campaigner and Liberian First Lady, Madam Claire Weah, said the initiative is intended to help women become active players in the growth and development of Liberia.
It means pushing for an inclusive society where the rights of all are respected and the opportunity for one to develop oneself evident. More so, the opportunity for women and girls to live out their true meaning, being given the most valuable skills, protection, and place to develop must be evident. Today, more than a movement, but a new way of life is being introduced in Liberia.
The First Lady recounted the struggle of Liberian women over the years and hailed the role played by former President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and current Vice President Jewel Howard Taylor in helping to lift the status of women in Liberia. Several First Ladies from the West African sub-region, including former model and Sierra Leonean First Lady Fatima Manabio, said First Ladies in Africa are no longer backbenchers but partners in pushing the agenda of development in their countries. She pledged her support to her Liberian counterpart, saying they share similarities in reliance.
And the unique thing Sierra Leone and Liberia has is the fact that we have war and we defeated them. We had Ebola and we defeated Ebola. They will not stop.
Liberian Vice President Jewel Howard Taylor said, female genital mutilation, or FGM, is one of the most immediate and human rights abuses faced by Liberian women and girls.
It's equally important to eliminate all forms of violence against women, including female genital mutilation. It now becomes our collective commitment and a call to duty by all of us. The time is fast spent, and we still have miles to go before we reach our goal.
The chief launcher of the She's You movement, Liberian President George Weah, acknowledged that development cannot succeed when violence against women is not dealt with.
Development cannot succeed or be sustained if violence against women is embedded in our social fabric of our society. I hereby launch the She's You movement.
The She's You movement, spearheaded by the Liberian First Lady, would like to see every Liberian girl educated and shielded from domestic and sexual violence. Moses Gazio, VOA News, Monrovia.
As the United Nations marks the International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence in Conflict this week, an initiative by the Foundation of Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Denis Mukwege is helping to end the stigma of rape survivors. Salim Solomon has the story.
Sexual violence is a devastating weapon of war accompanied by fear and misunderstanding. Perpetrators are often soldiers who act with impunity. Mildred, a survivor of conflict-related sexual violence from Zimbabwe, wrote, "Rapists have to be brought to justice. But how can we do this when the rapists are those in power?" Mildred is one of the women featured in a new initiative from the Foundation of Nobel Peace Prize recipient Dr. Denis Mukwege, designed to empower victims and educate the public about rape in conflict zones. In support of the UN International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence in Conflict, the Mukwege Foundation has created SEMA, the global network of victims and survivors to end wartime sexual violence. SEMA means speak out in Swahili, and the network includes 50 survivors across 21 countries. Milani Lakseminarian, program officer at SEMA, says the program aims to bring survivors together.
We focus on breaking the silence. We focus on building a collective memory. And what we do at the foundation is really provide a platform for these women to come together, to meet, to realize that they're not alone and become more empowered through this in order to fight for their own rights and demand their rights.
African countries are among the most affected by conflict-related sexual violence. In 2018 alone, the United Nations reported 1,049 cases affecting 1,041 women and girls and 8 men and boys in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and 238 incidents involving 1,291 victims in South Sudan, and 179 incidents affecting 259 victims in the Central African Republic. Although these figures are alarming, experts agree the vast majority of incidents go unreported. SEMA is working to break this silence.
I mean, what we've seen with the survivors is the moment that they see that they're not alone, they're much more ready to speak out.
The Mukwege Foundation provides a platform for survivors to share their stories. It also seeks to secure reparations for survivors and has a treatment model based on holistic care that includes psychological support and legal assistance. Mukwege, a gynecologist, treats more than 3,500 women a year from Panzi Hospital in the DRC. His work to heal rape victims earned him the nickname Dr. Miracle. Rape causes not only physical harm and trauma, it often stigmatizes women within their communities. Some are shunned and made to feel at fault for what happened. SEMA believes that creating an international support network can help decrease that stigma. Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
In the Gambia, an army general has confessed to torturing detainees during Yahya Jammeh's administration. General Alhaji Martin made a confession yesterday, Thursday, before Gambia's Truth Reconciliation and Reparations Commission, the TRRC. Pandero Mbaye reports.
Brigadier General Alhaji Martin has finally testified before the TRRC. Martin was a former close aide to the exiled Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh. His name has been mentioned by multiple witnesses before the TRRC commission. He has been accused of torture, among other human rights violations. Martin never denied the allegations.
At that time, when we asked you, you refused to talk. At that time, counsel, you repeated. That's how the situation was. If anybody by that time, you are alleged of something at that time, and then you refuse to talk, you must be beaten till the time that they might feel that now is enough, and then there is no evidence against you, then you'll be released.
Martin was a former Gendarmerie officer. He has admitted taking part in the July 22, 1994 coup, which had toppled President Jawara's 30-year rule. At first, Martin was deployed to help quell the coup, but he later decided to join the coupists. He was commanding a contingent of commandos at the time of the coup. Martin attributed the human rights violations in Jammeh's government due to what he calls lack of discipline in the army. He says the soldiers were acting recklessly.
The country was tough during 1994. The military discipline was not there. This is what brings all these killings. Discipline was the problem, Commissioner. Because if there was discipline, we'll not kill each other or neither torturing each other. But the situation at that time, discipline was lacked, fighting each other for positions. That was the order of the day at the time. We all know that in this country, people were fighting for positions. The junta were all fighting for positions at the time, killing each other.
The Gambian army officer has admitted assaulting the former junta vice chairman, Sana Sabali. He says Sabali and his co-detainees We are tortured during interrogation.
My apology to all the family of Sayang, Haidara, and Sana. We made mistakes, counsel. We were very young officers at the time. Where when orders are given, you have to go and then execute the orders, or else you will go. That's how the status quo was.
One of the TRRC commissioners, Lang Kinte, wanted to know from Martin as to whether his past actions were justifiable.
In your own conviction, what was happening in those days? Were they right? The atrocities, the tortures?
Absolutely,
whatever.
Never again, no, Commissioner.
I mean, never again from here, I mean before. Were they right?
Absolutely, that's what I'm saying, never again, wrong. Absolutely wrong.
They were wrong?
Wrong.
And you knew even at that time that they were wrong?
Yes.
Was it that you did not have choice?
That was the situation. It was the situation at the time.
No, but someone resigned because he knew what we were doing was wrong.
Martin also admitted that the panel that investigated the March 2006 abortive coup were engaged in falsification of statements, which were later used against the accused army officers. One of the accused officers was Bunja Dabo. Dabo told the commission that he was forced to write a post-coup statement by Martin and co. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandirimbai reporting.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, June 21st. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Malawi's High Court is expected to rule today, Friday, on the petition challenging the re-election of President Arthur Peter Mutharika. Lazarus Chakwera of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party and former Vice President Saulos Chalima of the United Transformation Movement Party are challenging the outcome of the May 21st presidential vote, citing voter irregularities and rigging. Meanwhile, the Human Rights Defenders Forum, a political pressure group, held a nationwide protest yesterday, Thursday, demanding the resignation of Electoral Commission Chair Justice Jean Ansah. Gift Trapence is Vice President of the Human Rights Defenders Forum.
We want accountability in the way how Malawi Commission managed the election. There were so many irregularities, but MEC officials were not taken to task in terms of explaining to Malawi so many issues. For example, the issue of PPEX, who blocked the PPEX in all the foreign centers, and yet Malawi Electoral Commission refused, saying that no one distributed PPEX, but yet the Malawi Electoral Commission officials were using PPEX.
How do you hold the Malawi Electoral Commission accountable or responsible for what happened during the poll? Because I understand to ensure transparency and to ensure the integrity of the election, political parties and stakeholders were involved in the entire process to ensure there were no shenanigans.
The issue of rigging was done by Malawi Electoral Commission officials, the employees of Malawi Electoral Commission. So for us to allow Malawi Electoral Commission to resolve their own issues when they are the culprits, I think that's where we have questions. Otherwise, Malawi Electoral Commission would have appointed an independent body to look at all the irregularities, because they were part and parcel of the rigging. And that's why we are saying that I think we need Malawi Electoral Commission officers to be accountable.
Some are suggesting that you organize this protest as part of a plan to put pressure on the court, which is scheduled to adjudicate on the technicality of the challenge of the electoral victory of Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika in the May 21 elections on Friday. And that is why you are doing this. What do you say to that?
For us, we don't sustain rights. We don't sustain freedom of expression because the text. In court, rights are supposed to be enjoyed at different levels. So for us, we are exercising freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, regardless whether the court is meeting or not. The court is an independent body. No one can stop it. We understand that. And the court should make sure that they are not influenced by anyone else. For us, what we are doing is just to exercise those rights, regardless whether we have cases in court now or tomorrow, but Malawians cannot be stopped, cannot sustain their rights.
Now that the protest is over on Thursday, what happens next in the near future in terms of your demand for election justice or electoral justice in Malawi?
One issue that we have demanded is for the next chairperson and the commissioner to resign. If they can't resign, we are going back to the street.
Gift Trapense is vice president of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Forum. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. South Sudan lawmakers booed the country's finance minister yesterday as he attempted to present the 2019-2020 fiscal year budget. The lawmakers were protesting the government's failure to pay the salaries of civil servants and security forces for the past several months. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Lawmakers in South Sudan's Transitional National Legislative Assembly stood up and demanded Finance Minister Salvatore Garang to leave the podium as he tried to present a proposed 200 billion South Sudanese pound budget. President Salva Kiir's cabinet approved the proposed 2019-2020 fiscal year budget about a week ago. Copies of it had already been distributed to the more than 300 MPs in attendance. But at the opening of today's session, Parliamentary Speaker Anthony Lino Makana appeared to have known something was about to happen, instructing MPs to allow the minister to present the budget and to raise any concerns later. But when Garang rose to the podium, the lawmakers demanded that he step aside, refusing to hear his budget presentation after the government stopped paying state civil servants 7 months ago and national civil servants for 6 months ago. Elizabeth Adud represents Northern Bargasal State in the Transitional General Assembly.
Our army is now cutting down the trees to make shackle for their children to survive. Our foreign mission are now 1 year we are not able to pay. Our teachers are not teaching our children. What are we doing?
Adud says because the government has not paid the salaries of security forces, soldiers now erect roadblocks to extort money from commuters so they can feed their families. The proposed new budget exceeds the 2018-2019 fiscal year budget by 100 billion South Sudanese pounds, but does not lay out how government revenues will pay for government expenditures. MPs say even though the cabinet approved the budget, they will not give their approval to a budget that does not explain its revenue or expenditures or pay government employees. Mabor says Garang should take the proposed budget back to the cabinet so that needed resources are mobilized and civil servants are paid.
This house will never be ready and cannot be ready to actually to accept the Minister of Finance present this budget to the house when 6 months' salary is not paid to the state, when 6 months' salary is not paid to the army.
Tanyi says if Minister of Finance Garang fails to pay civil servant salaries, he should be fired before a new budget is presented. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
An art exhibition in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, is shining a light on the real effects of phosphate mining in a Senegalese village. Artist Christian Daniel Lewis, who also studies the effects of mineral extraction in China and the Democratic Republic of Congo, has used artistic means to show how local plants, people, and buildings are negatively impacted by phosphate mining.
And it's part of a larger research project that evolves around the dark side of minerals, the minerals that powers our contemporary societies, or rather the dark side of the mining operations that extract these minerals from rare earth mining in northern China to extraction of coltan in the Congo to phosphate extraction here in western Senegal.
And what is the town in Senegal that you focused on, and what effects did people tell you were happening when you visited this town?
Right, so this village community that the project departs from is called Gat Gomene, and it's located very close to an open phosphate mine. And so it's affected by extraction of phosphate in the sense that it's very polluted. It has a very high concentration of sulfuric acid in the atmosphere that obviously you can't see with the naked eye, but it attacks the built environment and their plantations.
And what kind of plantations do they have? I know part of your exhibition you had a plant that was there that was eventually dying, and this was representative of certain plants in the town.
So it's basically mango trees and acacia trees that they have been growing in this particular plantation. And that tree you're talking about, which we brought into the exhibition space, is a very special tree. It's called Acacia albida. And it's actually considered to be a sacred tree by farmers throughout West Africa. It's considered to have divine powers. It has a strange reverse phenology, this tree, that gives it a unique ability to fix nitrogen in the soil. And by doing that, it can nurture this soil in a healthy and natural way. Researchers on agroforestry believe that this tree actually is the key to future sustainable farming.
That was artist and writer Christian Danielewicz. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Senegal's capital, Dakar. Time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin in Cairo, Egypt, where the 2019 African Cup of Nations kicks off later tonight when host Egypt play their opening Group A match against Zimbabwe at the Cairo International Stadium. The Pharaohs, led by Liverpool's Mohamed Salah, are among the favourites to go all the way to the finals in the Egyptian capital on July the 19th. Their opponents in the tournament opener, Zimbabwe, are having a back-to-back appearance at the finals after their early group stage crash in 2017. The Warriors have never gone past group stage in their previous outings, and they are eager for a good start against the host. Despite their coach Sunday Chizwambwa admitting it will be a tough outing.
I think, as you well know, that you have to be very cautious in these last few days, otherwise you get injuries. But otherwise, I'm quite pleased with what we did.
It will be the first time in the history of the African Cup of Nations that 24 teams will be featured in the competition. The national football team of Kenya, the Harambee Stars, will be returning to the African Cup of Nations after a 15-year absence. The Sebastian McNeese side played two friendly matches, winning one and drawing the other, few days to the competition. Coach McNeese, alongside the team's captain, Victor Wanyama, are confident of their team's chances.
It's an opportunity for our players to show their qualities. I'm not sure, under the pressure with this kind of event, what kind of reaction we can have on the field against strong team.
You know, when you win games like this, it gives you confidence going to the next one with the big confidence, and also more is a morale to us players. And it's just important to start this way.
Staying with the 2019 AFCON, the Democratic Republic of Congo gears up for their fourth consecutive participation in the African Cup of Nations with all optimism when they face Uganda in their opening game on Saturday. The DRC is drawn in Group A and will play with the host country Egypt, Uganda and Zimbabwe. Yusuf Mulumbu, DR Congo captain, says the Congolese are ready to settle for nothing in the land of the Pharaohs this time around except the trophy.
I'm very confident because, you know, we've been through so much in the groups, in the qualification, and that was good for us because maybe in that was a slap to come back in the basic for us.
In women's football news, Africa has two teams in the knockout stage as final day of group fixtures produce high-tempo games and outcomes on Thursday. Cameroon qualified by playing and winning against New Zealand, but Nigeria only had to look on as Thailand, the whipping girls of the tournament, thwarted Chile in a 2-0 loss. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that is it for this Friday, June 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Into the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour 24/7.
Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.